Welcome to Community Forum, a weekly call-in program produced at the studios of KSKA. Opinions expressed are those of the guest, host, and callers, and do not represent the views of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. And now, the host of Community Forum, Nellie Moore.
Good afternoon. It's a kind of a chilly day in Anchorage, so hopefully we'll warm up your afternoon for you, South Central Alaska. I have a guest in the studio here today to talk to us about something new in Alaska. I'd like to welcome Mr. Bud E. Fackrell, president of Denali Alaska Gas Pipeline LLC. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Nellie. It's great to be on your program today.
And if it's okay with you, can I call you Denali Pipeline after this?
You can just call us Denali if you'd like.
Okay. Let's talk about that a little bit. You haven't been on the show here before, and so let's talk a little bit about Denali, how it got started. I think probably people know, but for those who don't, we'll just fill them in.
Great. That'd be a great introduction. Well, Denali was formed in April this last year, and it's a 50-50 joint venture between BP and ConocoPhillips. And it was formed for a couple of reasons. I'll try to keep it short, but it's kind of exciting. One is both BP and ConocoPhillips have massive gas resources on the North Slope. And two is this is going to be a gigantic project, and it's very complex to bring this gas to market.
Mm-hmm.
And so those kind of projects generally around the world are done by what I call the majors, and BP and ConocoPhillips are the majors.
Mm-hmm.
So they felt like they needed to bring their worldwide engineering capabilities to bear on this project.
How does this compare to the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline?
Well, it's
the original pipeline.
The pipeline route itself, the Denali pipeline's going to start at Prudhoe Bay,
mm-hmm.
and it'll follow TAPS down to Delta Junction. And then at Delta Junction, it's going to follow the Alcon Highway into Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be a new route. It won't go down to Valdez.
Yeah.
And then once we get to Alberta, we're looking at an option of additional pipeline into the Chicago area. There already exists a pipeline network there. And what we're going to do is see if the customers want additional pipe that goes down into
which is Chicago. Quite significant, the availability out of Alberta, isn't it? And in other parts of the North American continent?
Well, there is a network of gas pipelines. Actually, Western Canada takes gas into the U.S. and then back up into Eastern Canada,
mm-hmm.
as well as supplying some gas into the U.S.
Good God, this whole gas thing. Where are you at right now? Obviously, you know, you're just getting your location set up here in Anchorage, your offices. You've got some employees. What have you been up to in the last several months?
Well, we've been very, very busy, Nellie. We're essentially still in what we call ramp up. And so what we've done so far is we've put an executive team together,
mm-hmm.
and we pulled those from both BP and ConocoPhillips. I've got 8 vice presidents, and these are high-caliber, world-class people. Secondly, we've conducted a summer program. That area from Delta Junction to the Canadian border,
mm-hmm.
we had about 80 people in the field this past summer working on things like archaeological sites, river crossings, ecology, those sort of
mm-hmm.
things. I've opened up 2 temporary offices here in town and 1 in Tokë. And then I've just a couple weeks ago announced signing a lease on some building space here in town.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be in the new building at Northern Lights and C Street. We've actually contracted about 40,000 square feet, which is 3 floors in that building.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, a couple other things we've done is we filed what's called a pre-filing with FERC. FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And in the end, in the U.S., they have to approve building a pipeline.
Right.
National Energy Board in Canada does the same thing. So we filed that and have approval on that. And then we just recently filed a right-of-way application on federal lands here in Alaska, the BLM lands,
right.
which is about a third of the route here in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Will your pipeline be crossing any native lands or here in Alaska?
Yes, it will. There are, as you get down between Delta Junction and the Canadian border, there are native lands
mm-hmm.
there. And we've actually, during our summer program this year, we worked a lot with the Tanana Chiefs Conference
mm-hmm.
On getting access to those lands and kind of building up a relationship with
mm-hmm.
them.
You said you were doing archaeological work. I know this is required, I think, on any project of this scope. Did you find anything significant in the course of doing that?
Well, what we were trying to do is identify archaeological sites, and then we're going to have to go back to those and do more detail. But we identified 70 archaeological sites between Delta Junction and the Canadian border. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing right now is not disturbing them. Mm-hmm. You identify them, and then you identify the perimeter of where they exist.
Sure.
And, of course, then what we need to do is decide, do we go around them? Do you excavate them? And that'll mm-hmm. be part of the detailed work that we'll do.
Were they, like, primarily burial sites or town sites or huts or a mixture?
I really didn't hear of any burial sites. Mm-hmm. I think there were some ancient villages and mm-hmm. artifacts and those sort of things. Of course, we didn't dig down mm-hmm. and excavate these sites. What we did is just identified there's something here and mm-hmm. tried to identify the extent of it. So there's still a lot of work to do there.
Yeah. It's interesting because when I was a kid, they were still finding a lot of sites, you know, in rural Alaska, and people would get really excited if they found a little, you know, area of homes or whatever that were ancient and buried. And it was always a big deal. Anyway, I want to remind our listeners, this is a live call-in program. If you're listening in the afternoon, if you're listening in the evening, you cannot call in because the program has been pre-recorded. This is your chance to ask questions about Denali, the pipeline project. And I have in the studio here today the president of Denali, Mr. Bud Fackrell. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, our toll-free is 1-888-353-5752. That's also on the internet at communityforum@kska.org. Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about AGEA. Can't talk about Denali much without touching on AGEA. That's the whole process that the governor and the state went through and getting bids and opening them and the selection of TransCanada. How does Denali compare to TransCanada?
Well, first of all, I think some people are confused about, you know, Denali, TransCanada. The AGEA law and the license being granted to TransCanada is not impacting Denali. We're moving forward. Our owners, BP and ConocoPhillips, made a decision not to submit an application under AGEA because they didn't think it was the right way to move the project forward.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, they formed this company. So we're moving forward independent of TransCanada.
And does this mean we could end up with two pipelines, or are you working with, or is there some coordination with the state at this point to maybe meld the two projects?
Well, at this juncture, there's not enough gas to have two pipelines, so mm-hmm. I don't think two pipelines are going to be built.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we have is both the state and, you know, the DNR and the producers, my owners, have the same goal in mind, which is building a gas pipeline. We have a difference of opinion right now on what's the best way to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a competition. In reality right now, we're competing against TransCanada. Now, I view that, though, not as a race. It's a competition.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, what I mean is I want to ensure we do it the right way. So when we get to the end, we've made sure we've crossed the right goal. And remember, this project needs to be economic. And one of the crucial things is that we understand the cost
mm-hmm.
and schedule this project.
At this point, how much have you spent on it?
We're probably going to spend around $60 to $70 million in 2008 on the pipeline. But the producers themselves have spent hundreds of million dollars over the years on this. The last real cost estimate was in 2001, 2002, and they spent $125 million putting it together. We have access to that data, but what we have to do is go in and relook at it.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, we need to have the lowest cost project possible, but it has to be feasible. And I have to attract customers into the pipeline. And so they have to have confidence that what we're doing, that we know what we're doing
mm-hmm.
in the end.
And I would imagine that once you get, you know, close to construction or at some point, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny as far as pipeline safety, you know, things like dealing with corrosion that we've had issues with in the past with the oil pipeline. Do those also happen with gas?
Well, not to the extent they do with oil, but you're right on, Nellie, is when I say we want to do it right, that's the pieces you have to do. We call this front-end loading.
Mm-hmm.
You really design the project up front before you build it.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, you need a world-class engineering team to do that. And I think that's what we've put together. Gas doesn't corrode like oil because this pipeline will have no liquids in it. And what happens in the oil pipelines is you get water that settles out in the bottom of the pipeline, and that's one of the most corrosive pieces of it.
Mm-hmm. At this point, it's estimated to potentially cost $30 to $35 billion. Is that right, where we're at?
Well,
I've heard different numbers float around.
Yeah, you know, that's the numbers that are being kicked around because no one's done an updated cost estimate.
Yeah, and this is a huge project.
This will be the largest project that private industry has undertaken in North America.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first of its kind.
Yeah. And as we were saying earlier, although people don't think too much about it, sometimes little things like archaeological sites can cause additional costs because if you have to go around or whatever, you know, a lot of unexpected things pop up.
Well, exactly right. And that was why I didn't want to lose 2008 for a field program, because we needed to get on the ground and particularly look at that area between Delta Junction and the border. We know a little bit more about the route from Prudhoe Bay down to Delta Junction.
What are your activities into the winter now? What will you be able to do that you're focusing on?
Well, we have a couple things we're doing. One is we're looking at a borehole program, so that'll be out on ice and snow, where we go out and drill shallow boreholes up and down the pipeline route.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very important one. The second thing we'll be doing is planning our 2009 field programs. And we will continue to have a field program here in Alaska, and then we'll have one in Canada. And then the third thing we're doing is preliminary engineering and design. Over the next few months, we'll be bidding out contracts for engineering design, which we'll hopefully execute in the first quarter of 2009.
That's pretty fast. As far as you say, you know, you're putting together a world-class engineering team, are you able to do that primarily out of Alaska, or have you had to bring people in to do that?
Well, amazingly, most of my leadership team is from Alaska, and they have Alaska experience. And for instance, one of the gentlemen that's the vice president for operations, he grew up, was raised in Fairbanks, went to school in Fairbanks, and worked here for a long time. In the last 5 years, he's been working in Baku in Azerbaijan, building the big pipeline that goes through three countries from the Caspian Sea to the Black Sea. So we have the advantage of having him on our team.
Mm-hmm.
We have a few people that don't have Alaska experience that are joining the team, and we picked them because they have the right skill set.
Mm-hmm.
But predominantly, this is a group of people that have lived in Alaska and want to be part of the project.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that really excites me, is the team wants to be here. They want to try to make a difference and make this project go forward, and that's the excitement we feel.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because people in Alaska seem to be very excited about the prospect of the pipeline and the jobs that are expected to come. And, you know, they view it as something exciting, whereas, you know, some people would probably consider being sent here to work like being sent to Siberia or something.
Well, you know how it is when you come to Alaska and you've been here a while.
Mm-hmm.
People say I came for a year and ended up staying 25.
Yep. Yeah, there are lots of those, and they're good Alaskans. That's all I can say. Let's talk a little bit about FERC. You mentioned the news got out recently that you submitted your paperwork for federal rights of way. That was done a little earlier this year, but the release was just recently made. And it looks like they're saying, yeah, let's go for it. And so what does that allow you to do?
Well, that was actually with the BLM, not with FERC. And let me just separate those out for people. FERC is the agency that will have to approve the pipeline. So they'll give you a certificate. It actually isn't a state agency. It's a federal agency because this is interstate gas moving to another state. BLM manages the federal lands in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And about a third of the pipeline will be on BLM lands. And so what we did is file a BLM right-of-way for the pipeline. What that allows us to do is you have to have an application in order to interact with the BLM.
Mm-hmm.
And we will want to do things like drill boreholes and have teams on their land. And so that gets this process working.
And then I see there is a FERC letter saying that you intend to file an application in 2011. Is that the first time we can expect to see the big application to build a pipeline, or?
Well, we've actually already filed what's called pre-FERC filing. I know this is it's really complicated, isn't it? But to try to make it simple is we filed with FERC, and they have a process where you file and they approve a preliminary plan. And so we already have that approved. What that does then is we're in the queue with FERC and they work with us. So they're actually interacting with my team almost on a weekly basis now. Mm-hmm. But the 2011 is when we actually filed the application for the permit.
Mm-hmm. Recently, or I don't know, some months ago, I had someone in here from ConocoPhillips, and we were talking about the project. And they were saying that because of the scope of the project, that it wouldn't be possible to purchase the pipe here in the United States. Is that still the case? And is there any, you know, chance that maybe some of this retooling they're talking about in the lower 48 might occur soon enough to magically be able to buy everything here in the good old U.S.?
Well, I think we'd all like it to be purchased here in the U.S., and we all have that goal in mind. Right now, this is probably going to be 48 to 52-inch pipe, mm-hmm. an inch in thickness. The mills in Canada and the U.S. can't build that kind of pipe mm-hmm. right now. But some of them are looking at this, and they may be able to modify their plants. But it's huge pipe.
Yeah.
And this pipe is twice as thick as the TAPS line.
Wow. Interesting. You are listening to Community Forum on KSKA. It is a live call-in program if you're listening in the afternoon. If you're listening in the evening, you cannot call in because the program has been pre-recorded. Our topic today is the Denali Gas Line. Give us a call if you'd like to join in. Bud Fackrell, the president of Denali, is my guest. Our number is 550-8433. We're going to go to the phones now. And Julie on line 7, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I've got several quick little unrelated questions, so bear with me. I hope you're not too swamped with callers. The first is, what's the website for the project?
The website is www.denalipipeline.com.
Okay. That was the easy question. I was curious about whether or not the fact that the line is going to parallel TAPS for quite a ways, does that make the permitting process easier? The fact that it does parallel TAPS, or is that just unrelated?
Well, it isn't unrelated. I think you've hit right on it. It does make it easier because there's an access road up and down that pipeline. And, you know, pipeline projects are about logistics in the end. They're about moving people, equipment, and steel.
Sure. And on the subject of the actual construction of the pipeline itself, I was interested when you were describing the size of it. Does the fact that it's going to be transporting natural gas, does that make the challenge of fighting corrosion easier or more difficult? I'm just curious about that.
It really makes it more, it makes it easier to do that. What we're going to be doing is the gas that goes in the pipeline will go through a gas treatment plant first at Prudhoe Bay. And I might just add, this will be the biggest gas treatment plant in the world. And it's going to do just a couple simple things. The gas has carbon dioxide in it right now, which is very corrosive. We'll take that out. It has a bit of water in it. We'll dehydrate it. And then we'll chill it and we'll pressure it up to about 2,500 PSI. So there will be no liquid at all in this gas. It'll all be gaseous phase.
Does that mean that the technology, the anti-corrosion technology, would be simpler than is necessary for, say, TAPS? In other words, is pigging going to be necessary and so forth?
Pigging, the famous pigs.
Yes, we will still pig this line. The internal corrosion on the pipeline will be much easier because of what I just described. We won't have all the corrosive opportunities in it. But the pipeline will be buried, unlike TAPS. So we will have to be conscious of external corrosion. So we will have to have a corrosion inhibition system in place on the pipeline.
How can you detect corrosion on a gas line that's buried?
Well,
lack of loss of pressure? Or?
Well, that's when it's too late.
Oops.
You know, so what we'll be doing is, first of all, the thing that's also unique about this pipeline is a lot of the ground is permafrost.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're chilling the gas to 30 degrees Fahrenheit. We can then set it, we can bury it in the ground. If it's warmer than that, it would subside or sink. So we'll be running pigs through the pipeline. We can run smart pigs, which essentially measure the thickness of the pipeline periodically.
Oh, okay. Any other questions, Julie?
Yes, I just had a thought when you mentioned about corrosion. I think Nellie asked, would the pipe itself be constructed in the United States? And that reminded me that I hope you don't run into the kind of problem that Alyeska ran into when they needed to replace a large segment of the pipeline, and they contracted to have the replacement pipe built in Italy, and then afterwards realized that they also needed to have it coated, to have anti-corrosion coating put on it, and that country, the manufacturer, was not able to do that, and so they then had to ship the pipe that was made in Italy, shipped it all the way to Saudi Arabia to have it coated. Well, it's no cheap feat to do that sort of thing. So I hope it goes smoother than that particular venture went. Anyway, thanks for the information.
Well, thank you, Julie. And you've really hit on an important piece here, though, which is corrosion. And this will be a very important piece of the design of the project. A lot of the pipeline will be wrapped. And then the part that's not wrapped will have what's called cathodic protection, which is an electrolysis process that keeps it from corroding. And then it'll be buried.
And what kind of wrap is this?
Well, it's like an
electrical tape?
No, it's fancy electrical tape. You know, it's, you know, here in Alaska, you use duct tape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's fancy duct tape.
Okay.
Well, I'm kidding, obviously. But it's a process that actually coats it in a manufacturing process, and it's bonded to the pipe, so it doesn't allow anything to get between the wrapping and the pipe itself.
Mm-hmm.
Not the whole pipeline will be wrapped, but some of it will be, depending on the conditions it's in.
Okay. And, you know, we've talked about corrosion. What happens if there is a leak? I mean, it surely it's not like a liquid leak. What happens?
Well, first of all, our goal is to not have a leak in this pipeline, and we're going to have a process to make sure that we have the best system possible in it. It is gas, though, and there are gas pipelines all around the world. One of the things we're doing is this pipe is going to be an inch thick, and it's going to be holding 2,500 psi of pressure. So if you have a leak, you're going to know about it very quickly. And in you know, it isn't just a pipeline with nothing in between.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, every 100 to 200 miles will be a compressor station, because as the gas moves, it's going to drop pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You will pressure it back up to the next one. You'll be able to measure the pressure drop in between those compressor stations. And so you have a good idea every 100 to 200 miles of what's happening in that section on a real-life basis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you are listening to Community Forum on KSKA. Today we're talking about the Denali pipeline. Give us a call if you have questions. This is your chance to get some answers. My guest today in the studio is the President, Bud Fackrell. We're going to go back to the phones now to Tom on line 5. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you very much. I got 1,000 questions, but let me start with a few here. Will you commit to powering your compressors with carbon-free renewable energy? Will you maximize natural gas production by sequestering all of your CO2 output on the North Slope in the gas fields? Will you consider reforming your heavy oil on the North Slope and shipping hydrogen south with your natural gas? Let me start with those three.
Well, Tom, that's a great set of questions. Obviously, from your question, this is about, is this going to be a green operation, if we could call it that? And one of the unique things about this project, Tom, is I mentioned the gas treatment plant. We're actually going to strip out the carbon dioxide from the gas, and we're going to re-inject that carbon dioxide. So that is going to allow us to turn this into, I think, a very green project. The second thing is right now the power that's generated on the North Slope to run all our operations, they're using fuel gas that has it's not sweet. It has carbon dioxide and sulfur and so forth in it. We'll be looking at should that we be generating sweet gas for them to use, which should reduce emissions as well.
Yeah, but what about sequestering the carbon dioxide from those turbines and putting that back in either the heavy oil fields as an extracting agent or to replace the natural gas in fields where you've got low pressure?
We're definitely going to be taking the CO2 off the plant, and we will be sequestering it. I know the engineers that work on the oil side, which we're on the pipeline side, are also looking at opportunities to use CO2 for improved recovery. Unfortunately, Prudhoe Bay is not a good application for CO2 floods, but some of the other reservoirs on the slope may be.
Well, the heavy oil above could be extracted with the CO2. The University of Houston at Houston did a study showing that, and particularly at Schrader Bluff, the CO2, 85% CO2 and 15% natural gas liquids actually did better for extracting the heavy oil than natural gas and NGLs. And so there's an opportunity there for using the CO2 from your power production in addition to the CO2 extracted from your raw gas. And what about down the pipeline where you're going to have additional compressors? Will you commit to using renewables at those compressor sites as well?
Well, first, back to the first part of that comment. When I mentioned before, there are other opportunities. The heavy oil is one. And, of course, that's still in the preliminary stage, but solvents are a way of improving recovery in heavy oil. So outside of our project, other teams will be looking at that. As far as the compressor stations go themselves, is we're in the design stage on those right now, and that's part of the work we're going to be doing this next year. But part of our goal is to have as green a project as we can.
Well, and you also want to maximize the throughput, and that's why I mentioned reforming the heavy oil so we don't gum up taps and we can trade the carbon credits from the heavy oil, which has, the most amount of carbon per energy output other than maybe coke and coal.
What you're talking about here, Tom, is the synergies that a gas pipeline provides here for us in Alaska. You're actually talking about two different projects, heavy oil and then a gas line. But I think you're right on here when you say, okay, there's going to be some CO2 generated from this project. Can you combine it together with other projects on the slope to improve recovery?
Yeah, and I think, since they're the same companies doing this, I think you owe us, to make those synergies happen. If we keep on, part of the problem with Alaska is that we're a resource state that's heavily invested in cutting our own throats by melting our permafrost and killing off our marine mammals, and so we've got to figure out a way where we don't, shoot ourselves in the foot, with global warming and still be able to produce our natural resources. And one of the ways to do that is to effectively sequester the CO2 we produce and to convert our heavily carbonized resources into clean hydrogen energy and ship that south instead of, like I said, shooting ourselves in the foot.
Okay, Tom, I want to thank you for those questions. I think we've heard that green is the way to go, and I guess in the future we'll be seeing what steps you'll be taking once plans become firmed up.
Absolutely.
Okay, I wanted to move on a little bit and talk about the global credit crisis. Is this having an impact on the Denali project at all, the horrendous economic problems we're having here in the U.S. and elsewhere?
You know, in the end, this project has to be economic. So anything going on that has to do with credit, price of natural gas, commodities and services, we have to consider all those elements. We are still moving on. You know, we're moving forward, but we're not doing it with our eyes shut. I refer to this as a marathon, not a sprint. This project's going to take 10 years to get gas to market. And during that period of time, the price of oil and gas is going to go up and it's going to go down. And so are commodities and services. But we still have to have an economic project, and we have to be smart about what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. If the trend continues, is there a chance that it could be pulled off the table temporarily? I mean, is there some point where you say, we've got to do a work slowdown here because things aren't looking so great? I mean, the price of natural gas, as you said, goes up and down, and right now it's declining. But as we all know, it moves.
Yeah, it's too premature to say that. I think where we are is we have to recognize that the project has to be economic. It has to make sense. You can't build a $30, $40 billion project and it not be economic.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good for anyone.
Yeah.
And right now, we think the fundamentals of the project still make sense. So we're still moving forward.
You are listening to Community Forum on KSKA. Today we're talking about the Denali Project. Give us a call if you have questions. The president is here, Bud Fackrell, to answer your questions. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. And if you want to get your calls in, you need to do that pretty quickly here. Our toll-free is 1-888-353-5752. That's 1-888-353-5752. And then there's email at communityforum@kska.org. Don't forget, if you're listening in the evening, you cannot call in because the program has been pre-recorded. Also in the news recently, Frank Murkowski, our former governor, called for the state and Exxon patching up their dispute over Point Thompson and their leases there. Does that impact you at all as far as the pipeline? Do you keep kind of an eye on that or not?
We absolutely do. To get very basic, is we need gas in this pipeline. Mm-hmm. And Point Thompson is a very important piece of that. With Point Thompson and with the gas that's discovered in Prudhoe Bay, there's about 35 TCF of gas between those. That's not enough to run the project for 25 years.
Sure.
So we're still going to count on expiration as well. But to get started, Point Thompson's a very important piece, and having that gas available, I believe, is very important to the project.
Mm-hmm. So on just that aspect, does that make resolution of this conflict more likely, or is the state being pretty rigid, in your opinion, with Exxon on this?
Well, I'm not involved in those conversations, so I couldn't tell you, but from a pipeline standpoint, is we want as much gas as possible. Because
mm-hmm.
remember, this is an open access pipeline. We're going to go out and offer our tariffs to anyone that wants to put gas in the pipeline. And when we finish doing that, we hope we will have enough gas to get financing and then submit our application.
Mm-hmm. Are there plans to have former Governor Murkowski be involved with the pipeline or be a spokesman for the pipeline?
I don't know of any plans along those lines.
Let's see. In your view, will a change in Alaska taxation be necessary to make this project more viable, more successful, more appealing?
From a pipeline company, I don't need any changes in taxation. But I have to have customers in TransCanada, Mid-American, Enbridge, Denali have all testified to along those lines. And by that, what I mean is the customers of the pipeline are going to make about a $100 billion commitment for tariffs when they sign up. And they want to know what is the tax going to be during that period. They want to have a predictable tax regime, mm-hmm. if you will. Because they're taking risk on the cost of the pipeline. They're taking risk on what the price of gas is going to be on the other end. So I think for us to have a successful open season, which is where we solicit customers, they're going to need to know what are the taxes going to be so they can run them in their models from a predictability standpoint.
And how far out does that need to be? Like, do they need to say, well, for can a state say, well, for 5 years you'll be taxed at this rate? And how does that normally happen? I mean, you've built a lot of pipelines. This has to be...
Well, generally around the world, when you build a pipeline, you go get financing. Mm-hmm. It's for the length of the project. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's a 20 or 25-year project, you know what the terms of that contract are going to be. Because remember, there's a lot of risk in this project. There's the risk of how much gas is going to be available. There's the risk of what is it going to cost and how long is it going to take. There's the risk of what's the gas price going to be on the other side. So if you also have the risk of not knowing what the taxes are, then the producers on the front end of it bear that whole burden. And remember, one of those is the state of Alaska, because the state owns a portion of this gas.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost of the pipeline is really only important to the producers in the state of Alaska.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, I think Governor Palin, and correct me if I'm wrong, has said that, you know, Alaska wants to get the best possible income for the state of Alaska. And I believe that at this point, you're still continuing to work on the tax issue. Is that right?
Well, Denali won't be. Again, we don't need any changes in taxes, but the owners of the gas most likely want to know what that regime's going to be. And I go back to what I said before, is the goal here is to build a gas pipeline. I think the governor, that's her goal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the producer's goal. That's our goal. So we all have the same goal in mind here. And it's about, let's get together and get this done.
And I guess, you know, that's the one thing that makes it a little bit confusing, and it's sort of what we talked about at the beginning is, you know, we've heard there won't be two pipelines, but there are two proposals out there at this point. And, you know, people are saying, well, what is going to happen?
Yeah, people want it simple. They want it solved right now. I was at the Resource Development Council annual meeting this morning, and the governor spoke, and I'll just...
Mm-hmm. Great.
You know, what I heard her say was, we have two companies that are competing for this pipeline, and that's good. Competition is good. And she said, we just want a level playing field, and we want a pipeline in the end. So I think that's really good advice from her.
Okay, back to the phones. Let's catch up. Bill on line 4, welcome to the show.
Hey, that's a good segue. I was just really curious. What happened in that last bidding process? I kind of feel like Columbo. It's like I'm going, well, can you please explain it to me so I can understand? I understand we gave some information to somebody, and they didn't give it back. What all happened there? Can you explain to me so I can understand?
Let's get a little more specific on the question.
Well, bidding process that the state had back in, was it last, a couple months ago, okay? And then, or was it a year ago? I can't remember exactly. But all I know is that the state came up with this deadline. We had turned some information over to a company. This company did not return the information to put in on the bid. So I'm confused what happened in that bidding process. And I was wondering if somebody, Nelly, you or somebody could explain it to me, what happened in the bidding process.
I am not sure what it is that you're talking about. And maybe someone can call in and answer that question.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Sorry. Let's move on to Pam on line 8. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Oh, thank you very much. And my main question is it possible for this technology to then be transferred to putting a gas line out to rural Alaska? West of the road system? And my second question is, what, if anything, would this gas line have to do with the Alberta tar fields, which are trying to produce oil but need energy in order to do that?
Okay, let me just see if I can address your first question. It's really a good question, Pam, because we know there's energy needs in the state. And the way I look at this is... What will really help is to get the big pipe built. That's what I call this 48 to 52 inch. Let's build the big pipe, because as we do that, it's going to leverage a lot of other things. Our plan is to have offtake points on the pipeline through Alaska. And we're looking at least five offtake points. So that gives an opportunity, if you have this big pipeline transmitting gas through the state, for companies to come in and build small businesses off of that. And there are a number of companies already that are talking about distribution systems off of this line. Denali's not going to build those. We're going to focus on the big pipe. But I've got an engineering team that will interact with anyone that wants to take gas off the pipeline and see if they can put a project in.
Is the technology so specialized that what you're developing is only for a big line, or would it make it so much easier to build, you know, just as a routine project to build lines out?
The reason that we're talking about building a big line is because of the cost of it, and it's just scale. So you need to have it big enough to have a scale to it. And what we're talking about is moving 4 billion cubic feet of natural gas to markets in North America. And let me just give you a feel for that. That's about 6 to 8% of the current demand for gas in the U.S. So it's a big piece. If you start trying to build a smaller gas line, it's not going to be economic to move that gas because of the scale of the project.
Thank you. I'll take the rest off the air.
Okay. Let's see. We're going to move on now to Rhody on line six.
Yes, that'd be right. I think you answered my question about pipeline, smaller bullet lines, but I'm also interested, is this gas going specifically to the tar fields, and how much of it in actuality is going to the rest of the U.S.? Thank you.
The big pipeline I'm talking about, the 4 BCF, this is targeted for markets in the lower 48, you know, kind of around the Chicago area.
I wanted to touch on the Alaska part of this, since we haven't done that yet. What are your policies for Alaska hire?
Well, our company is Alaskans when you get down to it. Most of the people we've hired so far are brought over from BP and ConocoPhillips, have been here for 20, 25 years, and we're going to rely on that. We're going to work with the local communities. In fact, we've got a project underway this next summer with the University of Alaska. These archaeological surveys and things that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. we need helpers out there. So we're working with UAF to put on a program to train students to be helpers mm-hmm. in the summertime. It's just a start. It may be 30 or 50 people, but it's the sort of thing that we're going to continue to look at. And remember, BP and ConocoPhillips have been in this state for 50 years. You know, people know us. We have all kinds of workforce development projects going on, and we're going to continue to leverage what they have inside of Denali.
You have said that you plan to invest a lot of money in training here in the state of Alaska. Can you describe what some of that will be and how, you know, people can get access to that?
Well, I've mentioned one already, this program with UAF, but what we're trying to do is formulate the strategy for that. We've already had some conversations with the Commissioner of Labor, Click Bishop. He has some ideas out there, and so there's actually a task force working on that. And one of the things that we will be doing this year is building our workforce development strategy for 2009. What is it we're going to do this year and the next year? Mm-hmm. And remember, again, we're looking at this is a marathon
yep.
out there. We can't do everything from day one, but we want to start getting moving on that piece of it.
I mean, it seems like with a tremendous project like this, just to anticipate the kind of hiring needs you'd have in the coming year, you'd need to start out pretty early.
Well, you do, but one of the things I kind of want to shift that conversation, Nellie, if I could, mm-hmm. is during the peak construction period for a few years, there's like 10,000 people working. But that really isn't that shouldn't be our focus because those jobs are going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
I think the focus is after the pipeline's in, there are a lot of businesses that could be generated up and down the pipeline route. And as we spent some time talking to mm-hmm. the Tanana Chiefs Council, and that's what they're talking about.
Right.
What are the other kinds of businesses that exist so that we can go in and train our people? You know, if it's a these compressor stations need maintenance crews. You know, even things such as if someone builds a propane business off the pipeline,
mm-hmm.
what are the commercial skills they need to have?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kinds of things that we want to focus on.
And I would imagine that some of the questions that Julie had earlier about providing more reasonably priced heating to rural Alaska, would this be where those would come into play, where a company would say, I'm going to go in and I'm going to pull some gas off the line and heat Village X, and that's going to be my business? Potentially.
What we will be doing is working with a company that has a business out there that they want to pull gas off of
mm-hmm.
to do. Now, remember, first of all, the gas will be 2,500 PSI. You can't put that in your home. You have to drop the pressure. And when you do that, you'll create propane and other liquids.
Mm-hmm.
So we will either have to inject that back in the pipeline or they'll have to have a business for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things you also have to think about is it may not necessarily be cheaper, but it may be stable.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, you have to have a business that makes sense and pull off of this.
I know in the villages, they're always going off the barges and what the price might be next year, and it's very unpredictable. Okay, let's pick up Dave on line 9.
Hello.
Hi, Dave.
Howdy. Great show. Hey, I wanted to call in on one thing is some natural hazard mitigation, but I also wanted to just touch on an idea that some other folks have kicked around on the show and that I've had conversations around town about whether it's called an offing plant or a gasification plant or whatever, right at the Yukon River crossing would seem like a logical place to, instead of building necessarily a whole other line, just have a plant to make it so you can ship it up and down the river at the Yukon. And one advantage of that is you could get stuff to the villages quicker and perhaps even later in the season, because you don't have to send it all the way out from Seattle or whatever to get there. So has there been any conversations about that is one question. And then the comment that I had is that I'm just finishing up my master's degree right now on glacier dammed lakes across Alaska. And the USGS did a big study back in the early 70s that they published 5 years before the pipeline was finished, the oil pipeline. And so the timing of this might be kind of important, because when an ice dammed lake releases, it can cause quite a bit of damage. The $5 or so million worth of damage in the Soldotna area a couple of winters ago was caused by a winter release that popped the river ice. One of the big pinch points along the TAPS route is Tasleena River, where there's about 4 glacier dammed lakes that they release and come all the way down. And they've had to do quite a bit of riprap or whatever around where the TAPS goes over or under some of the river crossings from some of these glacier dammed lakes. And so it's quite a hazard. It's ongoing. And what my study has found is that the lakes have shrunk, but they're still there. They're still a hazard when they release. They may flush some of the water out of the glaciers and just create a multi-fold increase in peak discharge than what most flood modeling would indicate. And so is there some works along line that are looking at these things, or is that coming up further down the pike as you get closer to a construction phase?
Well, you had 2 questions there. Let me just talk about the second one first, about the damming and the water systems. I talked earlier about our 2008 summer field program. A big piece of that was what we called hydrology, which was looking at all the river systems. And we were looking at the river systems just between Delta Junction and Canadian border, and there were like 500 in there. But we'll go back and look at those again in the wintertime, and we'll do borehole studies. So we do need to understand what these river systems are going to do in all the climate year-round. And again, remember, our pipeline at Delta Junction is going to head east down the Alcon Highway, not south to Valdez. The first question, comment you had about the Yukon is an interesting one. again, Denali is going to build a big pipe. We're not going to build a smaller projects off of that. Lots of other people can do that. You don't need us to do that. But we're going to have a team that interacts with them. And there's at least one party in the state that's already kind of kicking around this idea of a propane business up and down the Yukon. And we will clearly have a team that will interact with them.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing. It just seemed like a logical idea to put in there. But and yeah, I have understood that the Denali route would go down basically the Alcan route. And there's like the lakes that I looked at were everything south of the Tanana River. And there's like 700 lakes that I've looked at from the Tanana to the coast. And there's some other folks that have looked at and found something like another 500 of these glacier dammed lakes or basins that could hold lakes that go off of that north slope. And they looked at them in relation to the Alcan Highway. So these lakes are kind of everywhere. And so just by going that route, you won't necessarily be escaping the potential of these floods. And so is there a report that's been generated or that will be generated of this hydrology from the field season?
We absolutely have reports that we've put together on the work we did this last summer, and we'll continue to do that. Part of this also goes into the environmental impact statement that we're going to have to put together to get our certificate.
Okay, thanks for your call. We're going to remind our listeners, if you're listening in the evening, you cannot call in because the program's been pre-recorded. And just quickly, our local number is 550-8433. John on line 3, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, everybody.
Hello.
My question, you spoke about using local hire and having training programs for local people, which is good. I'm more interested in, I own a small business, and if it goes that far as getting into construction, actual construction of the line, will there be any kind of a venue or a avenue for us to seek any kind of contracts with helping you guys out on that pipeline?
John, great question, and one that's really important to us, which is how can we get Alaska content into the project? And as we put our contracts out there and look at our strategies, that's going to be a question we'll continually ask. How can we use local businesses? I think all of us know that a lot of times you may use a big worldwide engineering company, but they're going to have a whole series of subcontractors underneath there. And as we build the strategy for that, and it's still a bit early, those are one of the parameters we'll be looking at.
Okay, you are listening to Community Forum on KSKA. Today we're talking about the Denali Pipeline. Give us a call. The president is here, Bud Fackrell. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. And quickly now, Betsy on line 1. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you could tell me when you think the draft environmental impact statement will be done for the project.
Yeah, under the FERC requirements, we'll be filing the application in 3 years. So we have to have the draft impact statement done before then. Don't know exactly when it will be in that period, but the first portion of the project is about 5 years until we get the certificate approved from FERC. And it's the first 3 years is when we build the application, which has what you're looking at in it.
Okay, so will you be having scoping meetings prior to that? I'm just wondering when, as a community member, I can start weighing in and writing official comments.
Absolutely. FERC has a very detailed process, and one of those is engaging the communities. We actually have already started community engagement. When we went out and did our summer program this last year, we had a lot of engagement with the community, and we'll be starting that again this next year, particularly, primarily up and down the pipeline corridor.
Okay, I wanted to touch a little bit. You mentioned particularly up and down the pipeline corridor. Are there going to be possibilities for employment for people like on the Upper Tanana and Yukon River area? Can they, if they're skilled workers, do they need to come into the city, or are there potential opportunities for them in the field right there where they live?
Well, the company is going to be composed of BP and ConocoPhillips, Secondes. Those are people that are from those two companies will come to work for us, and then contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And so the contractors will probably be hiring most of those people. And what we're trying to do is make that available through the website, who is working for us, and then you can contact them on the kinds of jobs they have. We actually have a website out there now, and we're kind of going to be refreshing it over the next month to make it a little bit more interactive. So you can find that information.
Yes, and there is a lot of information on it, by the way. One thing that there was under Denali Terms of Service, you say rates will be distance sensitive for local use. What does that mean?
That's a nice term. It took me a while to be able to say that together. Rates are distance sensitive. It means if you're taking gas off at the Yukon River, you're not going to pay the same tariffs if you're taking gas off at Chicago.
Okay, beautiful. Okay, and then off the email from Rinaldi, the negotiations for the pipeline corridor seem to have ignored, at least in the Alaska public side, the fact that the pipeline will cross many First Nations land in Canada. Recent articles in Newsweek, September 2008, and many newspaper articles in BC and Yukon have cited the First Nations have not signed on to this project, and history upholds that the First Nations have blocked development and exploration efforts in the courts for upwards of 15 years. Is this also the case with what you're doing at this point?
Was that Rinaldi was the question?
Yes.
That was a great question. We're sitting here in Alaska and we talk about, you know, the Alaska Gas Pipeline, but there's actually more pipe that goes through Canada. You know, it's about 1,700 miles to get to Alberta. And about 700 of that is in Alaska. So it's really important what happens in Canada. And so where we are inside Denali is we're forming an entity in Canada. Both BP and ConocoPhillips have large operations in Canada. But stakeholder engagement, as we call it, engagement with the Aboriginal and First Nations groups is critically important. I was actually in Canada last week for 2 days with a good portion of my leadership team, and we were talking about that exactly, mm-hmm. How we interact with the First Nation and Aboriginal groups.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to be collaborative, and we have to start it right away. We're going to have a summer program in Canada this next year to do field work. In order for that to be successful, we need to have engagement with the owners of the land ahead of that.
I noticed that there is a group called Aboriginal Pipeline Group. Is that a group that you're working with? Or I noticed that they've been part of the Mackenzie Gas Project negotiations, and maybe there are some people experienced there that, I don't know, might be of some help.
We have people that have worked with them. There's actually a group out of the Yukon that we've already started working with. We've mm-hmm. had several meetings in Whitehorse with them. I think it's the Yukon Aboriginal Group
mm-hmm.
is the name. And they actually have quite a few connections into Alaska.
Mr. Fackrell, I want to thank you for being here today. I know you're a busy man, and hopefully you'll come back again and we'll get into the more meaty issues of the Denali Project. And thank you very much for being here on Community Forum.
Well, thank you, Nellie. It's great to be here. And thanks to the callers for their very very good and educated questions. It's a great project, and we're moving forward.
Community Forum is a production of KSKA's News and Public Affairs Department. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write to us. KSKA 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska 99508, or email us at communityforum@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/communityforum. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.